This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this New Books Network podcast. My name is Katriona Gold, and today I'm excited to be speaking with Kyla Summers about her new book, When the Smoke Cleared, The 1968 Rebellions and the Unfinished Battle for Civil Rights in the Nation's Capital. Dr. Kyla Summers earned her PhD in history at George Washington University. Her work has been published in the Washington Post, Washington History Journal, and edited collection Demand the Impossible, Essays in History as Activism. She's former editor-in-chief of the History News Network and currently works as digital engagement editor at American Oversight. Her new book, When the Smoke Cleared, has just been released this month, April 2023, with the New Press. It's an important account of the 1968 civil rights rebellions in Washington, D.C., their background and their immediate and continuing implications for both D.C. and the U.S. more broadly. The book is full of fascinating historical detail, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more about it. So without further ado, welcome to the New Books Network, Kyla.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great, glad to have you here. So my first question is always the same. Could you tell us a bit about yourself, maybe your academic trajectory, your personal history, whatever you'd like to share with us today?
Sure. So I grew up moving around a lot. But I came to DC in 2008 as a college freshman, also at the George Washington University, and fell in love with the city. And then at the end of my undergraduate degree, I didn't know what I wanted to do next. And so more school sounded like the right option. So I went right into a PhD program. And then while I was in early on in the PhD program, Michael Brown was murdered by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. And I was really fascinated both by the militarized response to the protests, but also the way that a lot of politicians and even some of the media avoided talking about the issue of police brutality and the solutions that were being proposed by instead criticizing the protesters. And so I knew that there had been rebellions in DC in 68. I started poking around a little bit and I realized that there had not been that much research done on it before, at least academic research. And so I said, I think this is what I should write my dissertation on. And I also loved it because it meant I got to stay in DC. And instead of flying around the world to go to archives, I rode my bike to the archives. And so then I wrote for a few years, turned it, you know, it became my dissertation. I finished that in 2018. I got a job. I didn't write for a little bit. I was just kind of enjoying being done with school. And then in 2020, when George Floyd was murdered, also by a police officer, there were nationwide protests in the U.S. And once again, D.C.'s got the I would say, got some of the most international and national attention. And it really felt like what I had written about a few years ago was just so relevant, especially as, again, a lot of times we avoided talking about, you know, the systemic issues at hand because legislators or the media would instead criticize protesters. So that kind of gave me the push I needed to write a book proposal and convert it from a 5-chapter dissertation into, I think it's 11 chapters, an 11-chapter book. And then it got published. But outside of, you know, that, I've been in DC 15 years. I love it very much. And it's just my home, and it's neat to get to write about it.
Right. Okay. That's so interesting. So this was your PhD.
Yes, it was. It was, like I said, a 5-chapter dissertation and it was definitely like, there was a lot more detail in that. And so one of the reasons that I ended up going with the publisher that I did was that they wanted me to shorten it, and others wanted me to make it longer. And I have a full-time job. I'm not in academia anymore. And so the proposal of cutting things out instead of having to go back to the archives or try and make it even more academic was really appealing.
Oh yeah, I feel we could all relate to that. I mean, I'm still writing my PhD, and the thought of completing it and then making it longer, my God. Well, this is obviously, the results are worthwhile. It's a fantastic book. For my next question, I'm thinking it would be good if you could tell our listeners a bit about why the 1968 rebellions matter in sort of broader historical context. So we've heard a bit about how you came to be interested in them, but why do they matter? You know, why does understanding the 1968 rebellions matter for understanding DC? Why does it matter for understanding US history?
Yeah. So, I mean, to really pull back, 1968 is just a watershed year globally. There's Paris in 68, there's the Chicago Democratic National Convention in 68, there's Vietnam War protests, it's sort of like 2020 in a lot of ways. It's one of those years that just so many huge crucial events happen, and there's kind of this feeling of shifting, like the world is shifting, change is happening, and so it initially ties back into that. A lot of scholars have written about 68 more globally. I'll be fully transparent. My book is only about DC. That was kind of one of the joys of writing it, was focusing so specifically on the local implications. But in 1968, the reason that the rebellions happen is that Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there's protests across the country, but the biggest in terms of troop involvement, number of arrests, and property damage are in DC. So one of the reasons that they matter is that they get both, they are the most, you know, the largest, but also it gets the most national and global attention. So it becomes, and it, you know, what happens in DC becomes a political talking point. Richard Nixon, when he's running for president that year, turns the issue of crime in DC to be a central part of his campaign as he's talking about law and order and the need for stronger policing and fewer protections for the accused. So it's, if you are someone that has been concerned about crime in the US, and then there is an event that leads to 6,000 arrests, all within the backdrop of, you know, building 1,000 fires burning in your capital, and, you know, it's getting international press coverage, like, you're going to make a big deal about it and use it as a central talking point as to why, you know, reform needs to happen. So I think the political implications and the political imagery that it creates is really important. But the biggest argument that I'm making in this book is that that's just one part of the legacy. And we've studied so much more the reaction of, you know, white suburbanites, who the message of Law and Order really resonates with, and a lot less about urban Black people who are living close to the damage, and what decisions do they make? What are the implications of this for them? And what I talk about is they don't, you know, turn away from, they don't give up, they don't, you know, they instead create these plans that say we're going to rebuild in a way that tries to resolve the central economic and racial inequalities that led to these rebellions in the first place. There's a reason that when a civil rights leader is murdered, that, you know, tens of thousands of people come out to protest. There's something political going on here. And so they create plans that really centered equality and Black power and economic opportunity in those plans. And I feel like, you know, a lot of them don't work out largely because the Nixon administration slashes funding and really makes it difficult to get them done. But it still is important to look and say, what did a majority Black city do in response to this crisis? And how did it envision a different world and a different city in the aftermath? So I think, yeah, both of those two ends of it make it really important. And I think it's also just important because, you know, we haven't stopped having mass uprisings. It still is a phenomenon. And every time that phenomenon happens, it's the same playbook where one group of people is saying this is happening because of deep-seated economic and racial inequality. And if we don't tackle this, these are going to keep happening. And then on the other side, you have people saying it's just a bunch of criminals, lock them up, and that's the solution.
Right. These are ongoing discourses today, of course. I think it would be really helpful for us to step back even further and talk about how DC came to be. And you talked about how the rebellions in DC were huge. How did DC come to be an important city for Black Americans, and how did race relations or the history of racial oppression in the city develop leading up to 1968? I mean, we know that the history of race-based oppression in the US is not one of linear progress, right? I mean, those of us who are somewhat familiar with it, but I think it might be good to give our listeners a sense of that broader, longer context from which these rebellions arose.
Yeah. So DC is a really unique city. We still to this day do not have voting representation in Congress. I mean, I'm going to go all the way back. DC is created in 1800 as the capital city. There was a debate by America's founders as to where the capital city should be. And Southern slaveholding states said, We need it to be from the South. It needs to be a slaveholding place, or else it tips the balance too far towards abolitionists. So DC is created by is carved out from the slaveholding states of Virginia and Maryland, and enslaved people build a lot of the capital city. Then we're going to fast forward to the 1860s when the American Civil War happens. And when the South secedes, the Northern states have all the power in Congress because the people that would have opposed them are gone. And so they emancipate DC in 62. And they also pass a lot of, like, kind of use DC as an initial, because they have control over DC, as a way to pass some of those reforms that they had wanted to happen. So during the Civil War, there are DC's Black population, I think it quadruples, and there's a very large Black population in DC, to the point that when DC men get the vote, DC Black men get the right to vote right after the Civil War. Black men are almost 50% of the electorate. So they have elections and they're passing civil rights reforms. They're electing Black leaders, and it's like they have political power. But a lot of the white populace hate this so much that part of the reason that that they end the ability to vote in DC. So DC had, they had had a leader that was spending too much money. It was getting into debt. That is a part of it, but it's also the fact that Black people had real political power, and they, white people in DC, thought that congressional rule would protect their interests more than democracy. So with the end of Reconstruction, which was the period after the Civil War, they pass something that sets up a new type of government in DC that gives everyone in DC zero voting rights. White people can't vote, Black people can't vote, and it is entirely appointed rule and congressional rule for almost 100 years. And so then, you know, but then you do have over the next few decades, like DC has the biggest Black population by percentage of anywhere in the US. It, because of the ability to get a government job, it is, it's a route to the middle class. DC also has some of the best schools for Black people in the country. And so it becomes the center, the cultural center of Black life in the US. And at the same time, there's always a lot of poverty. There's, you know, for all the elite or middle class, there's also a lot of people that are living in alley dwellings and working, you know, working tough jobs. But then with the, so yeah, there's a very large Black population there. Fast forwarding to World War II, it keeps growing. By 1957, DC is more than 50% of the population, or Black people are more than 50% of the population in DC. So it's a majority Black city. But while this is happening, DC still has never had voting rights. There's just, you know, like there is everywhere across the country, there's few job opportunities, or especially few opportunities for advancement. The schools are very unequal. You know, there's, it's, yeah, structural racism. And so during this period from the 50s into the 60s, you see the way that what activists are pushing for shift from, you know, just equal opportunity, especially after they, you know, legal segregation is no longer legal, but it shifts into demands for control and power and the ability to you know, almost self-determination for what happens in their neighborhoods. And this really overlaps with the lack of democracy in DC. That was long, but the point being, an argument that I make is that fear of Black power is always embedded into the governance of DC. And that's part of what leads up to the rebellions.
Right. So anyone wondering why DC still does not have statehood, this is where you want to be looking to find out. Yeah, so there are all these moments of hope and progress that get rolled back that we see in this history, and the rebellions are, they're a part of that picture. So the rebellions came about in the wake of the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., right? And I wonder if you could say a bit more about what caused them and what the initial local and national response were to them, sort of in the immediate, so as they were ongoing and in the immediate aftermath.
Mm-hmm. So Martin Luther King is assassinated. The news breaks first, not that he had been shot, not that he was dead yet, right when people are commuting home from work. And there's this intersection in DC that's 14th Street and U Street, and it's central for several reasons. One is that it's a huge bus line hub, and back then, that's how most people commuted to work, was on these bus lines. So you might be transferring, if you've been coming on Crosstown and now you need to go uptown, you would likely have a bus transfer there. There's a lot of, you know, shops and takeouts and everything. So this is kind of where you're running errands on your way home from work. The other reason that this is a really important intersection is that it's all of the civil rights organizations have headquarters there. So this Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which is the organization that King led, has an office building right at this intersection. And so a lot of people gather either around televisions or radios that are, you know, in shops a lot at this intersection, or by the SPLC headquarters to hear news. The crowds grow. Later, the news, in about an hour, the news breaks that he is dead. And, you know, you just have growing and growing, growing crowds. Stokely Carmichael, who's credited with coining the term Black Power, he is one of the most famous Black leaders in the country at the time. He was living in DC then, and he says, I'm going to go around to ask these shops to close. If Robert F. Kennedy died, which ironically he was killed a few months later, then they would want, this is what they would do for him. So let's see. So they walk, they go store to store, the crowd grows, eventually it grows angry. There's scattered instances of window breaking. And then eventually, even though Stokely Carmichael and other people tried to stop it, it erupts, and it's largely able to be contained that night. There's only, I think, like a couple hundred arrests, but then the next day is when things, grow to a huge extent. And there's, like I mentioned earlier, like over 1,000 fires lit. There's so many stores broken into. I think this is a much larger phenomenon, right? Like we've had riots after sports teams win championships. There's been, there's lots of reasons that human psychology says that this is a way of expressing grief and anger, or even excitement. So I don't have, but that's initially how it leads to the crowd dynamics that become this mass protest. And then what happens, there's a huge discussion afterwards of why were people out on the streets, why were they doing this. And something that I argue in the book is that I do think it's the general undercurrent is political, right? There's grief and anger at the death of King. They attack the places that the power of white people was most present in their neighborhood. So they confront the police, which they often viewed as an occupying force. They attack white businesses that were often very exploitative. And they also attack commuter highways where white people would come into the majority Black city on their way to work. But it's also very complicated, right? Like there's a lot of people that say, I just wanted to get something for free, right? And but there's also people that say, I wanted to get something for free, and this is my way of getting back at white power. So it's something that I argue is that there's no one underlying reason. A lot of times people participate for even conflicting reasons. Sometimes they say they participated on different days for different reasons, but it is important to preserve the political element of it, even if not every participant had that at the top of their mind or even thought that that's why they were participating. In terms of the reaction afterwards, it's DC, the city itself, uses this as a moment to say, we need to listen to what people are saying. We need to listen to what they want. They hold hearings where almost 100 people testify, 1,500 people show up, and they use what people say as the basis of a rebuilding plan that centers community participation, economic empowerment for Black people, and social equality. That's the most succinct way of saying that. And then at the federal level, it becomes a reason, it becomes a rallying cry for law and order. And President Johnson caves on some things that he hadn't been willing to do before. He passes a Safe Streets Act, which gives the police more power. And then you see Nixon using this as a central campaign issue, getting elected, and then really making DC the place that he experiments and uses it as a laboratory to try and enforce, to get these proposals passed that really give the police more power, limit civil liberties and create some of the basis of, the laws that make mass incarceration such a big issue in the US today.
Right. Yeah. That kind of interplay between using, well, the local and the national as well, like using DC in that way. One of the reasons I wanted to read your book was because I researched DC based bureaucrats, and you see these calls for, security measures that would be national in nature as a response to essentially crime panic about DC. You know, it's not safe to walk around the city I live in, or so on and so forth. And it's DC and the streets of DC being used as the evidence for why national security measures might be needed, which I thought was really interesting. So it's good to have this broader context. And I don't know how much of that carried through. I suppose I'm wondering what changed, you know, if you'd like to tell us a bit more about what did change in local and national politics in the decades post-rebellion, and how are we still feeling the effects today?
Yeah, so in the aftermath, DC creates the DC Council, which is also ironically presidentially appointed at the time, passes proposals that limit when police officers can fire weapons. They also pass legislation that gave the community more oversight over the police. So those are two things that I talk about. Unfortunately, both of those are not actually enacted because of pressure, that like anti-crime posturing pressure. But it is still, I think, really interesting that the first impulse, like one of the first impulses, is to, instead of strengthen the police, actually listen to the community and limit the police, even if they're not enacted. In terms of rebuilding, it's kind of complicated, but I really focus on a neighborhood called Shaw, which has been the historic center of Black life in DC. And instead of rebuilding, focusing on private developers, they create a plan that's focused on community groups, especially churches, partnering with the DC government and working with the community to create a plan. So they interview and ask the community what they want. They ask more than 50% of people that live in that neighborhood what they want the neighborhood to look like, which is pretty astounding. And they create a plan that has real community buy-in. It's also, like I mentioned, really neat because it's not based on private development. But they pretty quickly run into some issues, which is funding. You have to have enough money to do these programs, but you also need money because if you are rebuilding and trying to revamp places instead of just tearing everything down, you have to have the ability to relocate people because a lot of this is public housing. And they just don't have the units because especially because of a lot of policies that Nixon is putting into action, slashing funding or even banning new public housing building. So that limits it again, but the government still does they build a lot of new schools, they build new libraries, they build a lot of the things that the community had wanted. But as they're running into these issues specifically with housing, the city, or I guess the federal government more, turns away from the community rebuilding model and says that the reason that we're having these delays is community involvement, which I don't think was actually accurate, but this is what they say. And then they turn towards private development. So instead of working with churches, they sell it to the highest bidder and thinking that this will speed up redevelopment. But the private developers don't want to build there yet. They see these lots as a long-term investment, and so they lay vacant for a long time. And that's part of the reason that it took so long to rebuild and have rebuild those areas. So that's pretty internal to DC, but it still was interesting reforms. On the more national level, like I said, Nixon is elected. Within the first 2 weeks of him being in office, he comes up with a anti-crime plan in DC. A lot of those points become the 1970 DC crime bill that's passed in 1970, as the name suggests, and that gives the police a lot more power. They're able to do no-knock warrants, which is where you can just go into a home without knocking, giving people any warning. This is often really deadly for people because they're not anticipating. They'll react, and then the police think that they're a threat. It increases the ability to do wiretap surveillance. It also imposes a lot of mandatory minimum sentences, which there's a lot of literature on how that's really harmful, especially for disproportionately for communities of color. And that becomes modeled nationwide by a lot of other places. And Nixon also uses DC as, you know, to try and say his plan has worked. He sends a police chief on a national talking tour, touting all these reforms. He wrote police officers letters all the time to tell them what a good job they were doing. Anyways, it's a huge, huge program, but it doesn't actually reduce crime in DC, is the irony. And so just to bring things up to today, we're in another moment where crime in DC is really being intentionally politicized. There's been hearings on it in Congress recently. Congress actually recently passed overturned a law in DC that was seeking to modernize its criminal code and would have reduced the mandatory minimum sentences. And Biden signed it into law despite previously supporting DC home rule. So the idea that, you know, DC crime is important and requires federal intervention is still really potent today. So there's a lot of things that are, yeah, really remind me of this past going on.
Absolutely. It's a very timely book. I mean, maybe it would always have been timely in some ways, since these are issues that have been going on for so long. But it really does feel like this is a great moment to be revisiting these histories. I'd like to know, I mean, given how these things have carried forward into the present, I'd like to know whether you're planning to write more on any of this, or, you know, what you're working on now in general. I suppose maybe it's too soon to ask what your next book will be about, but I'd love to know.
I hope I can write another book. I think, like I said, I'm not in academia anymore. So I think if I can get back in a career that's a little closer to history, maybe that'll make it easier to get back to the archives. But I keep writing shorter articles about DC, especially because it just feels like what I've written about before is so resonant right now. It's so easy to politicize DC because we don't have representation, and we have this symbolism in the rest of the country that makes it really easy to manipulate and use it to political ends. So I write quite a few op-eds and shorter articles, but I don't know if there will be another long-term project, but I hope there is. I think the 50s in DC, this is mostly about the 60s in DC. I think looking at the 50s could be interesting. I think you mentioned a little bit the national security state and how that interplays with DC. I think something that I write some about in the book is how much like the State Department was interested in because when diplomats come to the U.S., they come to DC most of the time, and there was several really high profile incidents of like an African diplomat not being allowed to eat at a restaurant. And that does not look good in the press. That's not good for relationships with other countries. And so I think looking at how, you know, the fear of how anti-communism overlaps with efforts to desegregate DC could be interesting, but that's just one idea that I have.
Yeah, I look at the State Department, so that's absolutely something we should talk more about. And I look forward to seeing more of your work in future. In the meantime, it's been wonderful talking with you today. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Kyla. And thank you, everyone else, for tuning in today. Once again, my name is Catriona Gold, and I've been speaking with Dr. Kyla Summers about her new book, When the Smoke Cleared, the 1968 Rebellions and the Unfinished Battle for Civil Rights in the Nation's Capital, which was published by the New Press in April 2023. I highly recommend picking up a copy from your local bookstore, direct from the publisher, or from any ethical retailer. Thanks all for listening, and thanks again, Kyla, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.